I'll be talking about the self force and the green function in terrestrial space-time using a spectroscopy method. So spectroscopy decomposition of the green function. Okay, so I'll just start with the motivation for it, which is gravitational waves and extreme mass ratio black hole in spirals. Then I'll just introduce what the self force and what the green function is. And then I'll describe two different methods that we've come up with for calculating the green function, the self force. The first one is the analytical method, and I'll spend most of the time talking about this method. And then at the end, I'll just have a couple of slides about the numerical method and the results, and I'll just finish with some conclusions. Okay, so, I mean, some of the first slides are a little embarrassing for someone like PI, but just to set the scene, center of our galaxy, there's expected to be a supermassive black hole, about 4 million times the solar masses. The diameter of the black hole is expected to be between the distance between, average distance between the sun and Mercury. And what this is the black hole is meant to be there, and UCLA, well, there's observational data for 13 stars orbiting around the black hole, and because of the orbits of the stars and how close they get to the center, they can estimate the mass of the black hole and the radius of the black hole. So this is observational evidence, if you wish, for the presence of a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. And it's expected that there's a supermassive black hole similar to this one in most of the galaxies in the universe, and that there's all these small compact objects orbiting around them. And some of them are trapped by the gravitational field of the supermassive black hole and are going to be swallowed by it. So this is the main physical motivation for the work in this that I'm presenting in this talk. So during the spiral of the small compact objects around the supermassive black hole, there's an emission of gravitational waves. So the gravitational waves are taking away energy and angular momentum from the physical system, and they are carried away to radial infinity. And you can have interferometers in our planet detecting these gravitational waves. So what do we get from the gravitational waves? Well, we can map the space-time near black holes and far distances from in our galaxy, sorry, in the universe. They provide tests for general relativity and alternative theories of gravity. And also, you can have gravitational waves coming in from the early stages of the universe, so you can get data from those early stages. This is observational motivations for the study of these in spirals, but also the two body problem in general relativity is a fundamental problem in general relativity, so there's theoretical interest in solving that problem in itself. Okay, so again, the first few slides, you probably, most people here already know this inside out, but what are we doing? We're solving Einstein's equations. We didn't know how to do that in general, so there's different methods or different approaches for solving Einstein's equations. One is the post-Newtonian approximation, which is valid for when the two bodies, for small velocities, so at the early stages of the spiral. Numerical relativity so an important breakthrough in the last few years. So numerical relativity is a valid method for when the ratio between the masses is of order 1, order 10 if you wish, and there's even a paper claiming to have some results for order 100. But certainly it doesn't reach any mass ratios any larger than that, and it's not expected that they'll be able to tackle this regime in the near future. So for mass ratios much larger than this, namely between 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 8. This is the extreme mass ratio in spiral regime. What we do, it's a ripe regime for linearizing Einstein equations. So you use the ratio of the masses as a perturbation parameter. So the total metric describing the physical system of the two compact objects is given by the background metric of the supermassive black hole, and a small perturbation caused by the smaller object orbiting around it, and then some second order perturbations. So calculating this first order perturbation to the gravitational field of the supermassive black hole is the aim of the research that we carry out in this talk. Okay, so how do we go about this? How do we model the small black hole or a small compact object orbiting around a supermassive black hole? In the test mass approximation, the small object follows the geodesic of the background spacetime, but we want to model the first order correction to that in the mass ratio. So you can think of it as the small object deviating from a geodesic of the background spacetime as caused by a so-called cell force. So the cell force is caused by the field of the small object acting upon itself. Now, that suffers from divergences because you're calculating the field on the particle itself, on the small mass itself, so you want to regularize it, and you follow the principles of covariance and causality, and then you come up with some equations for the cell force. So I'm not going to get into regularization procedure, I'll just give you the equation for that, but it's a rather involved calculation. What's interesting is that, physically interesting, is that you can view the motion of the small body not as a perturbation from a geodesic of the background space-time, but rather as following a geodesic of the background space-time metric plus the regularized perturbation metric. So that's a very satisfying way to view the motion of the small object. So again, this is trivial, certainly for the people in the force. In the first couple of rows, but just to say, if you want to have a feeling for what the cell force is, it's the gravitational equivalent of the Abraham-Lorentz Dirac force, which is the force that an electrical charge suffers in flat spacetime whenever it's accelerated. So the gravitational equivalent of that is what I'll be talking about in this talk. Now, I should say there's two main standard methods for calculating the cell force, and that's done not via calculating the Green function, like I'll be talking about in this talk, but by calculating the field. These two main methods are the mode sum regularization method, led by Barak and his and collaborators, and the other one is the effective source method, which was a method originally suggested by Steven Detweiler, and other people like Ian Vega and Barry Wardell have been doing very interesting calculations with this. Now, in this talk, I won't be talking about these two standard methods, but rather I'll be talking about new methods which calculate the cell force via the Green function. These two standard methods calculate the cell force via calculating the regularized field. Just to say, just a couple of slides on important astrophysical achievements by the cell force community, which have been obtained by using those standard methods. It's the first one is the correction to the frequency of the ISCO. So this is a plot of the effective potential in Schwarzschild spacetime as a function of the radius for different values of the angular momentum of the small object. So whenever there is a minimum of the potential, you have a stable circular orbit, but there is a critical value of the angular momentum of the small object at which you can have a stable circular orbit, and that value is the innermost stable circular orbit. So that's a value, and the orbit, the small particle has an angular frequency at that orbit, and that value of the orbital frequency is something that you can infer, that you can get from the gravitational wave observations. So from cell force corrections, calculations, one can find the correction to the angular frequency at the ISCO, and this was obtained with these numerical methods, and this is the value that they found the correction to the angular frequency, orbital frequency at the ISCO. No, this is a gravitational calculation. Sorry? So certainly these next results have been checked against post-Newtonian calculations. So there's been a lot of comparison with post-Newtonian and numerical relativity. So, I mean, one of the things I should say is that, so the cell force is meant to model extreme mass ratio spirals, but there's indications that they can reach down to intermediate mass ratio spirals, in which case you can compare to numerical relativity. So I wasn't too sure whether this in particular was checked against numerical relativity, but I know there's comparisons.
Yeah. Alexander Lutsiak and company just put out a paper, maybe it was last month, on periastron advance in their crust. But EOB? No, it's post-Newtonian and self-force comparison to numerical relativity perception, and they find good agreement in terms.
Thanks. So the ones I'm talking here, so I just, the papers I'm referring to here were the original calculations of the paper. So this one in 2010 was a comparison with EOB and post-Newtonian calculations. But like Aaron says, there's been comparisons with numerical relativity. So closely related to that, there is the correction to the precession effect. So basically, and this is the radial frequency and this is the angular frequency or a mean. There should be hats here. This is not the omega here, but there should be hats here. So basically, one is what it's just a Keplerian calculation. The first order in the eccentricity, so these are for small eccentricity, the first correction here is from a test mass using Einstein's equations. And then this second correction is due to a self-force calculation. So this is giving you the first correction to the test body mass in the correction in the limit of small mass ratio. Okay, so for some people in the back who perhaps are not so acquainted with this, so general relativity tells you there's an advance in the periastron of the elliptic orbits, and the self-force is giving you a correction to that shift in the periastron advance.
I don't know how this self-force is being calculated, but if I just took mainly some perturbation of my space-time, and then I calculate nabla mu, t mu nu, just the divergence of my stress energy tensor, like effective stress energy tensor, will this give you the self-force or not really? Because in the first approximation, it gives you the heuristic equations. So I'm wondering if you can do some perturbations, and it would give you the self-force. Mm-hmm. Or this is not how this is being calculated at all.
No. So I'll give now the formulas for it. I mean, I'll give you now formulas for it, how it comes in. But that's, I'll give you now a formula for it. Just to complete on results achieved by the self-force community, one thing is the calculation of the self-force, but ideally what you want to do is solve for the equations of motion of the small object and the self-force. So the self-force depends on the motion of the small object in a way that I'll say in a minute. And the self-force and the equation of motion obviously depends on the self-force. So you want to solve for the two equations simultaneously. That's been done in the scalar case. It's embarrassing I haven't put the names of the people here, but Barry Wardell, Ian Vega, Stephen Detweiler, and Peter Diener did this calculation. So this is for the scalar charge. In the gravitational case, what has been done, all this is in Schwarzschild, by the way, in the gravitational case, what has been done is not the self-consistent orbit, but the geodesic orbit in which you calculate the self-force by assuming that the particle has been all the time in a geodesic, which is tangent to the current, to the real orbit of the particle. That's been done by Lior Bragg, Neil Warburton, and perhaps somebody else. Okay, so this has been achieved with these methods, these two methods I talked about, standard methods, where they calculate the field. Now, what is lacking here is that there is no insight at all about the origin of the self-force. Like I said, this is just a value there that they calculate numerically by calculating the regularized field, but there is no understanding of what's going on. So the main thing I would like you to get out of this talk, especially the people who are not so acquainted with this, is the interplay there is between the geodesics of the background with propagation in the background, the null wavefront and the origin and the self-force. Okay, so this is the expression for the self-force in the case of a scalar charge. In the case of a scalar charge, that was obtained by Quinn in the year 2000. And the self-force can be obtained as an integral over the past world line of the particle, coming in via z tau, which describes the it gives you the position of the particle, and integrating the retarded green function of the wave equation satisfied by the perturbation. And you need to differentiate it to get the cell force. But some local terms which are rather trivial, and I'm not going to be talking about them. Okay, so this is the expression for the scalar cell force, and there is equivalent expressions for the electromagnetic cell force for a scalar for an electrical charge moving in a curved background, and for the gravitational cell force. Algebraically, they're more involved, but the gist of it, of having an integral over the past history of the whirl line of the particle of the green function, is exactly the same. So the green function just satisfies the wave equation. On the right hand side, you don't have the source corresponding to the small object, but rather you have a four-dimensional delta Dirac, and you want to impose some causality boundary conditions. Okay, so the important thing about in here is that the retarded green function of the wave equation in the curved background is very important in order to calculate the cell force using this method. So a lot of what I'll be talking about is about this calculation of the green function of the wave equation. Okay, so I'll go on now to describe the analytical method that we've come up with in order to calculate the cell force. So this is the thing, this is the quantity that we want to calculate, and the method, which is called the method of match expansions, what it consists of is splitting the integral into two different regimes, one for early times and the other one for distant past or times far away in the past. So this is the whirl line of the particle, and you can think of a null geodesics or a null wavefront being emitted at this point. And at some stage, because it is not flat spacetime but it's curved, at some stage the null geodesics are going to cross again the whirl line of the particle. At that point, it marks the so-called normal neighborhood. So it essentially gives you the end of where there's a null geodesic connecting this point zeta and any other point along the whirl line of the particle. And then in this other regime is what I call the distant past. So we're going to do an integration between all the way from minus infinity up to some point inside the normal neighborhood, and then from that point onto the current point. So we're splitting the time integration into different regimes. The reason why we do that, well, just a couple of technical points. First of all, that matching value in time, there's no reason why it should exist in principle. So one has to do the calculations in order to see whether it exists or not. There were some preliminary indications by Anderson and Wiseman in 2005 using weak field approximation for the distant past that there was very poor convergence in the calculation of the Green function in the distant past, so they thought it was not a viable method to do. But with Sam Dolan, Adrian Notable, and Barry Wardell in 2009, we could apply this method into the case of a black hole toy model spacetime, which is an REI spacetime, which is two-dimensional, the sitter crossed with the two-sphere. So we did a full calculation using this method there, and it was successful. Now, I'm not going to talk about an REI spacetime, but I'm going to talk mostly about Schwarzschild spacetime. Okay, the reason for the split of the integral at early times and at distant times is because we can use different methods at early times and at distant past. So at early times, what we use is the so-called Hadamard form for the retarded green function. So what this is there's a direct part in the Hadamard form, which is U delta sigma, and a tail part, which is V theta minus sigma. Sigma is the one half of the square of the geodesic distance between two points, x and x prime. And the important thing is that sigma is equal to zero along null geodesics. Sigma is less than zero, it's negative, whenever the two points are time-like connected. And it's positive whenever the two points are space-like connected. So U and V are two bitensors. They're regular bitensors. The handicap of this formula is that it's only valid in the normal neighborhood, so we're unfortunately not allowed to use it in this distant past region, but it's very, very useful for calculations in the normal neighborhood. Why is it useful? Because I didn't say this, but regularization, what it tells you is that you integrate only up to You don't include the current time in the integration, in the world line integration. So it's very simple to exclude the divergence. All you have to do is, because it only has support along the world line of the particle, this U delta sigma term only has to support at coincidence whenever x is equal to x prime. All you do is you just exclude this term here, and all you do is include V theta minus sigma. Theta minus sigma is just equal to one, it's trivial inside the world line. So all you have to do is calculate this bitensor V, which is a geometric bitensor. You just can, you can calculate it just using from the Riemann tensor, if you wish, locally, evaluated locally. So there are many methods in place in order to calculate V. I'm not going to get into the calculation of V, but you can do a covariant expansion in terms of sigma, or else you can do a WKB non-covariant coordinate expansion of V. Now, this is an expansion for whenever the 2 points x and x prime are not too far away from each other, which is what you get inside the normal neighborhood. And this little coefficients there, they are geometric coefficients, which you can get expressions for them in terms of the Riemann tensor. So I'm not going to go into any results about this. I'll just give some plots later on. But this is conceptually, it's a quantity that's relatively easy to calculate. Okay, where there's more meat is in the distant past. So, so what we have here is a depiction of Schwarzschild black hole. So this is the Schwarzschild black hole, and we have a particle here following a circular geodesic around the black hole. So again, before it was a plot, it was a space-time plot. In here, I just have a space plot, but I have no geodesics coming out from this point x, and the orbit around the black hole. So let's see, the first one is this one here. So this, the first one does like this, and it goes back to hit the world line of the particle in a circular geodesic, and it hits it at this point x prime. Then you're going to have other null geodesics that orbit the black hole. This one orbits it in the opposite direction, and it goes back to hit the world line at a later time at x prime. You have another one, the green line here, that orbits the black hole like so, and it hits the world line at a later time, and you have an infinite amount of null geodesics orbiting around the black hole an unlimited number of times and going back to hit the world line of the particle. Okay, so why is this important? Because there's some theorems, which is the propagation of singularities theorems, that tell you that the Green function is singular along whenever the 2 points, the arguments of the Green function, are separated by, are light-like separated. They have, there is no geodesic joining the 2 points. So if you calculate the retarded Green function between this point here, where you want to calculate the self force, and any one of these points along the world line of the particle, you're going to get a singularity. You're going to get a divergence in the retarded Green function. Yeah?
The normal neighborhood was supposed to be the region within which you could be intersected by. Was that the definition of the normal neighborhood?
Let me give you a quick definition would be whenever there is only a single causal geodesic joining the two points. So whenever you have, so in here, that's the end of the normal neighborhood because you have two causal geodesic joining x and x prime. One is the time-like one here, and the other one is the null geodesic there. So up to here, I can use the quasi-local expansion, and then from here on, I'm going to have to use other methods. This is a consequence of the existence of caustics, which are all the points, well, it's a line of caustics along the antipodal points because, it's the fact that the null geodesics are orbiting around the black hole. So their focusing caustics are the points where the null wavefront, where there's a focusing of the null geodesics. So what's interesting, mathematically, what's interesting that's happening is that the character of the singularity of the retarded Green function is changing at the caustic points. Okay, so all I'm saying here is I'm going to be presenting a whole series of results. They're all in Schwarzschild for scalar charge, and we've done it for eccentric orbits as well, but just for definiteness, I'm just going to be talking about the circular geodesics that are equal 6m. this work with Sam Dolan, Adrian Ottewell, and Barry Wardana. Okay, so what do we do? How do we calculate the distant past? Okay, there's different approaches to this, and the analytical approach that we follow is this one here. We do a multipolar decomposition in terms of the Legendre polynomials, and we also do a Fourier transformation of the modes, so that we have an integration along the real axis of the Fourier modes of the retarded gain function. Now, we go a little further, and instead of calculating the integral along the real axis, so this is the complex frequency plane, real omega, real frequency and imaginary frequency, what we do is we deform the contour, and we bring it down the negative imaginary frequency plane. And in doing so, the residue theorem tells you that you have to pick up the singularities that you encounter in there. So what do you encounter? You encounter simple poles of the retarded gain function modes. They're the so-called quasi-normal modes. And there's a branch cut along the negative imaginary axis in the frequency plane as well. So the final retarded gain function is given by this high frequency arc down here, the simple poles, which are the quasi-normal modes, and integration along the branch cut. Now, the high frequency arc, there's no rigorous derivation of this, but there is calculational evidence for it and indications that it vanishes after a certain finite amount of time. So I'm not going to be talking about the high frequency arc anymore, but I will be talking about the quasi-normal mode contribution and the branch cut contribution. Okay, so how do we calculate these green function modes? Well, typically, we've brought the problem down to a second order ordinary differential equation in the radial coordinate. So all you have to do is you want to find two linearly independent solutions of the ODE. One is what I call R in, and the other one is what I call R up. And this is the famous Reggio-Wheeler equation that you wish to solve for. This is most of the results I'll be presenting actually for the solution of the modes are for general spin 0, 1, and 2. So what two linearly independent solutions do we choose? Well, the ingoing radial solution is one which has amplitude 1 coming in from sky minus. Most of it is, or some of the wave goes through into the horizon, but some of the wave is reflected back, is backscattered back to radial infinity with some transmission coefficient in and some reflection coefficient out. And the upgoing radial solution is one that it's coming out with, so it's going into future radial infinity with amplitude 1, and it has some initial incident amplitude coming from the horizon and some reflection amplitude going back into the horizon. So two linearly independent solutions that we wish to solve for. Okay, so what are the quasi-normal modes? Like I said before, they're simple poles of the retarded gain function modes. So you can express the retarded gain function modes like so, R in and R up at two different values of the radius divided by the Wronskian. So the quasi-normal mode frequencies will be wherever the Wronskian is equal to 0. These are the consequence of that are that they obey these boundary conditions. And this is a calculation of the quasi-normal mode frequencies that we could do. These are the exact quasi-normal mode frequencies. So this is again the complex frequency plane, and as the multipole number L increases, the quasi-normal mode frequencies move along to higher values of the real part of how quasi-normal mode frequencies increases, and as N increases, the Overton number increases, the imaginary part becomes larger and negative, larger in magnitude and negative. So the imaginary part just gives you the decay rate of the oscillation, and the real part just gives you the frequency of the oscillation. Okay, so how do we calculate the contribution to the retarded gain function coming from the quasi-normal mode sum? Well, you just use the residue theorem to tell you that you have to add the residues at the poles, at the simple poles. So this is the formal expression for it. I'm just going to have one slide later on about how we calculate R in and R up. We did some convergence analysis of where this quasi-normal mode sum converges, and it converges for these values, and I put an approximate value, approximate sign here, because there is a certain arbitrarity in the origin of the tortoise or star coordinate. So there's two sums in the quasi-normal mode sum contribution. One is the n sum, and then you still have to add all the L modes. So this you have convergence for late enough times, if you wish. And for the L sum, you never, there's no time after which you have convergence. You're always going to have certain divergences. And those divergences correspond to the divergence of the of the retardogen function in the distant past. I'll show that in plots in a minute. What about the branch cut? Okay, probably everybody knows. Just an example of a branch cut is the log of omega in the where omega is a complex variable. So the imaginary part of log of omega is the argument of omega. And what that tells you, if you take the principal part, is that there's discontinuity in the for in the negative axis, because here, if you come up from above, the imaginary part is minus pi, is pi, and if you come up from below, it's minus pi. So you have a discontinuity of the log omega of 2 pi. And in fact, this trivial example is not too far away from what's actually happening in the retardogen function. Where, what's the consequence, what's the source of the branch cut? Why is there a branch cut? And you can trace it down to the shape of the potential at for large radius. So at large radius, the effective potential in the Reggie-Wheeler equation goes like, it has a power law behavior, it goes like R squared. And it's the fact that it decays slower than exponential that leads on to the existence of a branch cut in the solutions that are defined at infinity, which is the R-up solutions. If you go near the horizon, which is R star going to minus infinity, the exponential has exponential decay. And that tells you that the solutions, which are the Arian solutions, which are defined near the horizon, are going to have simple poles along the negative imaginary axis. The simple poles are not, don't have any physical significance because you divide it by the Wronskian and it gets rid of them.
You mean it still has the spread part?
Yeah. Don't quote me on this, but I really think so.
I thought the branch part is due to because it's like you have this Coulomb type long range action far away. Like as long as it's not Coulomb type, then
I think this might not cause a branch cut at all. I think the centrifugal part of it does not cause a branch cut, but it's rather this bit here that's causing it. So I think no matter what, as long as it's a decay is lower than exponential, it's going to give you a branch cut. Okay, so again, how do you calculate the branch cut? Well, you want to integrate along the negative imaginary axis along the branch cut, and you want to integrate this discontinuity of the Green function modes, so which is symbolically depicted by delta. It's a discontinuity of R-up. R-in has no discontinuity along the negative imaginary axis, but you want to calculate the discontinuity of R-up solutions along the negative imaginary axis. Okay, so this is just a formal expression for how you calculate the branch cut modes. So basically, everything is calculated in terms of R-in and R-up solutions. Now, you still want to look at the convergence of this integral. So the integration of the frequency, nu is just the frequency along the negative imaginary axis. So again, it converges at the same times approximately as the convergence of the quasi-normal mode series. Okay, so I just wanted to give one slide just so that people have an idea, vague idea of how we calculate this function. So what we do it analytically. So, well, for large omega doesn't really matter too much in terms of the cell force, but basically the gist of it, what you want to do is you want to complexify the radius as well so that you have something that's well-behaved, if you wish. So you can get some asymptotics of these solutions by complexifying R as well. So I'm not going to get into that. For small frequency, we use the MFT method by Mino, Sasaki, and Tanaka, and Taguchi. And what it is, basically, all it is you express Rin and Rop as an infinite series over some special functions that you know well, such as Coulomb functions or hypergeometric functions. That's for small frequencies. For mid frequencies, we used a similar technique. This was an expression given by Lever in 1986. And the series, instead of being in terms of hypergeometric functions, is in terms of Compton hypergeometric functions. This is particularly well suited to studying the branch cut, because U has a branch cut in the independent variable here, and you know exactly how the discontinuity of U is along its branch cut, and you can evaluate that, and you can get that the branch cut modes are given as an infinite series of the confluent hypergeometric functions. Okay, so results. Okay, so first of all, let's look at the questionable modes. So I'm going to be showing a lot of plots where on the left-hand side, it's log plots. Left-hand side, I've got the green function or contributions to the green function. And on the x-axis, I've got time. So evolution with time, I've got r and r prime fixed equal to 6m, and the angle is just moving, the particle is just moving along a circular geodesic, so the angle is omega times delta t. Okay, this is a log plot, and I don't want you to look, I'm going to concentrate more later on what's happening here exactly, but the main thing I want to point at here is that the black line is for the overtone number n equals 0, blue line is n equals 1, this reddish color is n equals 2, yellow n equals 3, and n equals 4 is the green one. So for large enough times, n equals 0, the lower overtones clearly dominate over the larger overtones, except for very early times where chaos, if you wish, or lack of convergence is occurring. But from any times from 20m on, you have good convergence of the questionable mode series. Okay, so at these times here, it's not good to use the questionable mode series. But for any other times, you can almost ignore. You can almost get away with just n equals 0 and n equals 2 if you wish. Okay, for the branch cut, just a plot. So this is the branch cut modes in terms of the frequency along the branch cut for different spins. Green, red is spin 0, green is spin 1, blue is spin 2. I just want to point at this particular feature here, this particular funny behavior that the spin 2 behavior has. This is in the algebraically special frequency, which there's been a lot of analysis being done on, because you can solve for the radial solutions exactly at the algebraically special frequency. So in order to calculate the contribution to the branch cut, you want to integrate along the frequency, and that will be your contribution to the branch cut. Okay, so a similar plot to the one I just showed for the quasi-normal modes. This is a log plot of the branch cut, contribution to the Green function from the branch cut as a function of time. And instead of n, I'm using L here. So this is L equals 0, 1, 2, and 3. So again, clearly for later times, the L equals 0 in the branch cut dominates over, the lower L's dominate very clearly over the larger L's. To the extent that you could almost get away with just the L equals 0 and L equals 1, it's interesting to see as well how the L equals 0, so the black line is the sum of all of them, and it has a little wiggle, if you wish. So it's you can see how it's dl equals 1, which is just pl cos gamma. Pl cos gamma with l equals 1 is just cos gamma, and cos gamma. So for l equals 1, for l equals 1, you just have cos gamma. We're in a circular geodesic, so the oscillations here just correspond to the frequency of the orbit, and whenever you sum it to the green line, it gives you this little wagging of the tail, if you wish. Okay, now I put together quaternional modes and branch cut together. So I sum all the quaternional modes, I integrate the whole branch cut, and I put them together in order to get the green function. So again, it's a log plot. In black, if the sum is the total green function, so the sum of quaternional modes plus branch cut, blue is just the quaternional mode contribution, and red is the branch cut contribution. So the main feature I want to point at here is that the branch cut gives you this power law tail decay that everybody knew about, which is 10 to the minus 3 in the scalar case. So it's the branch cut is completely dominant at late times, but we found the next correction to it, which it already starts bringing in some logarithmic corrections in the tail, which people hadn't really had. They had suggested it happened, but nobody had actually calculated in detail. In orange here, I have the quasi-local contribution because I can't push branch cut and quasi-local modes to very early times, so I have to match it to a quasi-local contribution. So that's what the branch cut brings to it. I should say as well, like as opposed to what a lot of people think and say in the literature, the branch cut is not just a contribution to late times, but you can see here how there is strong contributions from the branch cut at early times and at intermediate times. So that's unlike with a lot of people in the field. Sorry? Or how it does depend on how this behaves. Well, it's not early enough to take delta t equal to zero because this is, you can see how here we're starting to run into problems. Just the two guys basically what's happening here is the two guys, quaternional mode contribution and branch cut, are starting to diverge. And you want the divergences to cancel out in order to get something that's regular. But we can't do asymptotics for small times of the branch cut.
Power law dependent at early time. It looks like, I guess,
well,
at some point.
It
still looks like
power
law.
Well, you start having the logs coming in, and it is, I think at that stage, it is still well approximated by, well, you need power laws, and definitely you need log t's as well, so a combination of those. Okay, what about the quasi-normal mode? So here is a zoom in into that regime that was quite messy. Okay, I'm zooming in to this. There's a lot of meat, a lot of interplaying going on there. So what's exactly happening there? So instead of a log plot, I take away the log plot and just a plot of the green function as a function of time in that regime. So again, black is the full green function, blue is the quaternional mode contribution, red is the branch cut. So at these points here, 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 and here, what you have is divergences in the green function due to null geodesics going back to hit the world line of the particle again. So remember that plot that I gave before. So we started sometime x, and I am in null geodesics. So the first one does like this, and it goes back to hit the world line of the particle there. So this point x1 here is this point here. Now what's interesting is that the singularity form of the green function is not delta sigma like you had in the normal neighborhood, and the Hadamard form tells you, but it has a 1 over sigma type of behavior. Then you look at the next one is the orange one, so it does like this. It goes through two caustics, one caustic here, one caustic point there, so it goes through three caustics. So x1, so blue is the second one, so it goes through one caustic, two caustic, and it goes to hit the world line there, and it has a minus delta sigma type of behavior. The third one is the green line, and it goes through three caustics, one, two, so the it goes this way. So it's one, two, three caustics, and it goes back to hit the particle. Okay, I'm not sure now where it's going to, it seems to go through four contexts. I'm not sure, but it should be. I mean, it should be. So it's one, two, three, and then it seems to go through a fourth one there. So perhaps I mean, it should certainly be going through one caustic, going through two caustics. Oh yeah, sorry. So that was right. So the orange has gone through three caustics, one, two, three caustics. The green one has gone through four caustics, one, two, three, four. So every time you go through a caustic, the null wavefront goes through a caustic, the character in the singularity of the retargeting function is changing, and it's following a fourfold pattern. So it goes back, after going through this, it goes through back onto a delta sigma type of singularity. And that's just given completely by the quasi-normal mode contribution. And that's been calculated exactly that is the case. OK, this is just a plot to tell you that we validated our results against some numerical integration that I'm going to show later on. And it is very accurate and good. Another plot just to show that there is a matching between the quasi-local contribution and the distant past contribution, the distant past calculation coming in from the quasi-normal modes plus branch cuts. I should say the quasi-local calculation is limited by getting very close to the normal neighborhood where the V, Hadamard by tensor V, starts to diverge. The quasi-normal modes and branch cuts are limited by the divergences at early times and by the fact that we only can sum up to a certain finite value of L, and we can't go to L equals infinity. Otherwise, it would just have a strict divergence. And here's a result for the self-force using this method. So we calculate what is so-called the partial self-force, which means that we integrate not all the way from minus infinity to the current time, but some finite time in the past and the current time. So as delta tau goes down to infinity, you have the full exact self-force calculation. So this is a plot of the partial self-force as a function of this delta tau here. As it goes down to infinity, it reaches the value, the dotted value there, which is the exact value calculated using one of the other methods. Here you can see how the singularities in the Green function affect the self-force. Here you have the first, the 1 over sigma type of singularity. So it shakes it. This is a little whip, if you wish, but it goes back to values close enough to where it was before. Similarly here, it encounters the next singularity and it shakes it, and here very closely it comes through the following singularity. But every time it gives it a shake but goes back to a value not so far away from the one before the singularity was encountered. So one of the interesting things that this method tells you is how far back in time do you have to integrate in order to get a good value for the self-force. Well, pretty much after a third light crossing, after a third singularity, you get a value that's very, very close already to the exact value of the self-force. And we're getting the exact value for the self-force up to with a relative error of 1%. We could improve that, but that was not really the point of the method. How am I doing for time? Is anybody? How much longer?
Maybe 8 minutes, and it's maybe 8 to 2 or something.
Okay, so in fact, I'm very close to finishing. So I just want to mention another method, which is a numerical method that's done with the same people as before, but with Chad Galli and Anil Zenginoglu. That's a paper that we should be putting out in the archive this month. So what we do is we calculate the Green function, in this case numerically. And the way we do so is by using the Kirchhoff integral representation for the field solution to the wave equation. So you can calculate the field at any point in time by integrating the retardating function or convoluting the retardating function with some initial data. This is initial data for the field, this is initial data for the derivative of the field. So if you choose your initial data carefully, in this way, so initial data for the field, we choose it to be 0, And the initial data for the derivative of the field, the time derivative of the field, which is it to be a Gaussian distribution with, and the Gaussian distribution for very small, in the limit of zero width, it goes down to a Dirac delta distribution. So as long as the width of the Gaussian distribution is small enough, we're approximating a Dirac delta distribution. And so the result that you obtain by evolving the field numerically using these initial data will approximate the retarded Green function. Now that seems like a crazy idea, but what's crazy about it is that it actually works, and it gives very accurate results for the cell force and for the Green function. So this is a little video which is telling you how, what is the evolution of a peak Gaussian around the equator of a Schwarzschild black hole. So this black cube there is the Schwarzschild black hole. The initial Gaussian is going to be somewhere around here, so close enough to the horizon, and you're going to see how it spreads around. So what this is giving you is it's the value of the retarded Green function where the initial point is here, and then any other point argument of the Green function is wherever you look at it. So if you wish, it's close enough as to how an initial pulse, infinite pulse, is propagating in the Schwarzschild black hole. Okay, so here you go. You have the pulse, and it's orbiting. Well, some of the wavefront is going away. It's moving away to radial infinity, but some of it is actually wrapping itself around the black hole. There's a spherical symmetry, obviously, so it's wrapping around in both ways. So this is the null wavefront that's wrapping itself around. This is the one that's going away down to radial infinity, and this is going to keep doing so. It's going to keep wrapping itself around. So the null geodesics, which is what the wavefront is following, is crossing caustics every time. And it's hard to see this as a numerical calculation, but in here you have a delta Dirac type of singularity. In here you have a 1 over sigma type of singularity. In here you have a minus delta sigma type of singularity. In here you have a minus 1 over sigma type of singularity. So you can see here from a numerical evolution how the shape of the wavefront is changing as it wraps itself around the black hole. Some results for the cell force. So this is, again, we're looking just at circular orbits in Schwarzschild at r equals 6m, but in here, it's not always geodesic orbits. So if omega is equal to omega geodesic, so the value here is 1, that would correspond to a geodesic orbit, but you have accelerated orbits with different values of the angular frequency. So z would be a static particle, and here it would be a light-like orbit. And as a function of time, so here you have the value of the Green function. There's a log plot of the value of the Green function as a function of time, and the dotted lines are the values wherever the azimuthal angle phi is equal to pi here, 2 pi, 3 pi, 4 pi, 5 pi, and so on. So you need to integrate this Green function along time in order to get a value of the field. So here you get a value of the field as a function of omega. So for different values of omega here, which correspond to the vertical axis there. And this is the value of the field as a function of different values of the orbital frequency. And this is for the different components of the cell force. So this would be the radial component of the cell force, time component of the cell force, and the azimuthal component of the cell force. And we can do the same, not just for circular orbits, but for eccentric orbits. So for different values of the eccentricity, so the different orbits here are parameterized by the eccentricity. And we plot here the value of the radial component of the cell force, time component of the cell force, azimuthal component of the cell force as a function of the frequency. And the value of the cell force is always evaluated at the same point, P. Okay, so just to wrap up, so the method of match expansions has been applied. We've applied it successfully to Schwarzschild spacetime. What are the advantages of this method? Well, trivial regularization, because all you do is you use the Hadamard form, and so you just calculate the retarded Green function using V, the Hadamard by tensor V. It gives you physical insight in terms of how the wavefront is propagating and how the null geodesics behave in the background space-time, and how that gives you the singularities of the Green function. It's tantalizing, in terms of practical calculations, one, it's tantalizing to see how well you could get away with just using n equals 0 for quasi-normal mode contribution and n equals 0 for branch cut, because those are the dominant, overwhelmingly dominant contributions to the Green function. Just to note that all we're doing is solving an OD, so a second order linear OD. And the advantage of using Green function methods is that whenever you've calculated for all pairs of points, now that once is a big once, if you wish, but once you have that, you can obtain the self-force for any orbit, not just geodesic orbits, but bound orbits, unbound orbits, or any geodesic that you wish. So thank you very much.
So as we can see from the numerical simulation, the Green function, like costing, is quite different from other.
Exactly. So I didn't say that. So I talked about the fourfold singularity structure. That's not always the case. Indeed, along caustic lines, or rather than caustic lines, I should say, for phi equals 0 and pi. So if your initial point is here, and you wish to calculate the Green function, so that's a null geodesic, and that's null geodesic is another null geodesic is going back, as going the opposite way as well. So if you wish to calculate the retarded Green function where the other point x prime is here or is here, is along this line, then the retarded Green function, okay, I can't remember now which, but in one case, if it's here, it has a twofold structure. So in one case it's a delta sigma, it will be minus delta sigma first, plus delta sigma, and then minus delta sigma, and so on. And in the other case, now I can't remember which, I'll now think about for a second which one, which is which. But in the other one, you have a one over sigma and minus one over sigma. So you have a twofold, along these lines, you have a twofold structure. I can't remember right now which one is which. I think they're swapped, actually. I think this one should be here and this one should be there, but anyway. So just to say, so there's different, so for example, there's other space times, like for example, in Bertotti-Robinson space time where I calculated this as well. It's a twofold structure. Some people, whenever we find this singularity structure, some people believe that it was related to the topology of, or to the fact that there's spherical symmetry in the spacetime. But for example, in Bertotti-Robinson, it has spherical symmetry, but the singularity structure is only twofold. It's delta sigma minus delta sigma, and so on.
So for the numerical results, I'm a little bit familiar with Chad and Anil's work before on the causes. Yeah. It seems like if you could compute the cell force by integrating their numerical Green function over an orbit in Schwarzschild, it should be basically trivial to do the same in Kerr. So are you guys also doing this for an orbiting Kerr?
Right. So what they did in their paper was to model, so they replaced, they approximated a Dirac distribution by a narrow Gaussian in a different setting. The setting was, it was a 3+1 Dirac delta distribution, and it was in the source of the wave equation. So they had the retarding function, four-dimensional delta, and they approximated this by a Gaussian. In our case, what we're doing is, we still do an L-mode decomposition of these guys, of the retarding function. And then you have something here, let me call it GLRT. And it's in the initial data for this guy that we replace the delta, in that case a one-dimensional Dirac delta distribution. So we're relying on this. I'm not sure, so we have to find the, we found that this method was a lot quicker and accurate as this method for calculating the self-force. That's why we did this. Now, we have to find an equivalent of this in care. There's ways to do it, but we'll just have to put a little bit of thought into it.
You mentioned the infinitely many orbits if you fine-tune the initial data of the geodesic. But on the other hand, you have finite amount of radiation, tiny amount of radiation. But so given, I mean, assuming you've computed the cell force, shouldn't you be in a position of answering the question, how many orbits can you maximally have? Because every time you go around, say, you lose a little bit of energy, a little bit of angular momentum, and at some point, aren't you, well, if we go to classical geodesics, no radiation whatsoever, you can, by fine-tuning the parameters, the initial conditions of your particle, you can have infinitely many orbits, as many as you like. But if you have radiative losses, this cannot be true. Either you go to infinity, or you're going to fall into a black hole. So I'm asking, is it possible to calculate using the self-force, for example,
Before the small black hole falls into the.
Because without radiation, it's you can go around as many times.
So you can calculate the number of orbits, the number of times that the small black hole will orbit around the larger black hole before it plunges in. So it scales like, I can't remember this.
Yeah.
The scaling with the mass ratio. And
the inverse proportion of the mass is a small particle. Because of the radiation, the radiation is proportional to a small mass square. Mm-hmm. And total energy is proportional to a small mass times big mass. So the actual time is.
So that's a scaling for it. What was disappointed to see is that the algebraically special frequency doesn't do anything. It doesn't. I was expecting to see a little chirp or a little smile in the Green function, but it doesn't do anything at that stage.
Set. Okay.